course it wasn't done by us. It's an art piece by Massive Attack and Adam Curtis. But I think it summarized very clearly all the situation in the past years. And I selected this quote by David Green to start because I think we have been here talking about issues such as memory, nostalgia, politics, economics. And there are things that make you feel uncomfortable somehow. So it's a good quote to start talking about all of this. So first of all, I want to tell you the story of the island of Nauru. It's a small island in the Pacific. It belongs to New Zealand. And I like to talk about this island because I think it's a very good example of the history of capitalism condensed in a very few years. This island was super rich in phosphates because of the droppings of the seabirds. So it has a very rich source of natural resources. And at that moment, in the late 80s, even the government has protected the island. You can see the wider space. It's for the land who were protected. And the people who used to live here has one of the highest income per capita in the 80s. But what happened? Capitalism arrives and neoliberalism. And they start exploiting the island, even if it was protected by the government. So, you know, when there is money, even the laws and regulations fall down on that money. So now, the island that was super rich has been transformed in that. You can see all the green area is abandoned, and they only have this airport because now it has been transformed into an immigration detention center. And the only way of living of the people who was super rich 20 years ago is working on that center nowadays. So I think it's a very good example to start talking about all the economical policies that has happened in the past 10 years. Let's say even if we all know that the big collapse started in 2008, but to have this collapse in 2008, we have a previous actions and people working on neoliberalism movements, etc. We can go even back in time until the 80s, when we were able to witness
the speeches. From France to the Philippines, from Jamaica to Japan, from Malaysia to Mexico, from Sri Lanka to Singapore, privatization is on the move. Something new had been born. Its name was popular capitalism. Returning power to the people. That is the way to one nation, one people.
So we can see that not everything started in 2008. It has roots, and we can go even far from Margaret Thatcher. But I think it's a good period to talk about these issues. So how this capitalism and neoliberalism and economical policies has affected also our cities, our public space, the way people interact with the city. I want to show these images because I don't know if here in Vilnius you are familiar with the concept of Black Friday, that it's on the 29th of November, I think. It's the day it started in the US, and it's the day that you have discounts for everything you want to buy. So people start buying like very compulsive, even things that they don't need, just because it's on discount, so I want to take advantage. And we very easily forget that to have that queues, crazy queues, there are these kind of queues in other places in the world. People that it's forced to work more, to produce more. So it's very interesting to think that capitalism is always there, taking advantage of our human way of behaving. And it starts colonizing all our dreams and ideas. And I very much like this project by White Think Tank in China, that they took the Constant New Babylon and make a visual essay just to show this notion of colonization by capitalism. And they did this graphic mixing up the New Babylon with the Southdale shopping mall in the US that was the first biggest shopping mall in a cover area in the world. It was air conditioned, all the people was going there to spend their time, and at the end they start buying and spending their money only in the stores that were there, and they forgot that there are other kinds of public space. So I think it's a very provocative visual essay because makes you to reflect on this way that the economics rule our world. Also, we can see in the news since 2011, more or less, we have very familiar to this kind of images from the Arab Spring, 15M in Spain, the Occupy Wall Street, Getse Park. But nobody think what is behind also. You can see these kind of images. So capitalism is colonizing even our stronger dreams, you know? Because you go to the protest, you think that having this mask, you are part of a revolutionary movement, and you don't pay attention. We very easily forgot that there are people producing this to take advantage of your feeling of rebellion and revolution. So I think that one of the most important things we need to think and to have in mind is to think beyond the superficial layers we have and try always to go behind to the other ideas and other motivations. So we have reached a moment that it happens in all our cities nowadays, that there's no money, so people start thinking, okay, we have tools now, we can start a new model. But what have been the main models we have seen in the latest years? A techno-positivism, a techno-fetishism, I call it, with 3D printers, bitcoins as an alternative system, but three months after the first bitcoins start rolling around, we also start reading in the news that they have been robberies and scandals about corruption. So even if the model is new or the technology is new, we still behave in the same way. Or with the race of the drones, now I was super surprised to see this webpage that puts drones on demand. Okay, so I can rent a drone, but even I don't know what for. To deliver pizzas or to send your Amazon buys, as we have also seen. So I think we need to reflect on the ideas behind these projects, or Norman Foster proposing to 3D print shelters for the moon when there is a lack of shelter here. Why go to the moon? So, you know, so that's why I like this quote also by Madeleine Albright, that she said recently that we are talking about the 21st century challenge, but our mind is still shifting the past because we have the most newest technologies, but we don't know how to use them. So it's very interesting to have all this context and this reflection when we start about talking about architecture and public space or design as well. So I wanted to talk of the concept of emancipatory architecture because emancipation means to be free from regulations, from law. But also I like to relate the concept of the word emancipatory with Jacques Rancière, the ignorant schoolmaster, that in this book he shows how you can learn and how you can you talk and share your knowledge even if you don't have any accreditations or you are not a professional. And this is happening now with all the bottom-up strategies we have seen that emerged in the past years. People taking action in the public space with architecture students that are super young doing pop-up stuff just to try to take back the right to the city. So to talk about this concept and then to discuss with you about this, I will show so a few projects that they are not only architectural ones, but I think all of them has a relationship with public space and with the city. And also because I was wondering in the past year how these pop-up and emergent solutions can evolve, because I think they have been really good in the context we were living in, for example, in the Occupy Wall Street, building the small library or the area for coffee or whatever, or activities we have seen in small squares everywhere in Europe or in the world. But they are super temporary and very ephemeral, and even if for a week or two, they make better the life of the people living there, children have a place to go and play, but they haven't succeeded in provoking really structural changes in our cities or in our political system. So I don't have any solutions. I will not present you conclusions. I'm still wondering how can we transform these kind of projects to something more long scale, long term projects. So I think we can start with this project in New York. And it's a good example because it's not new. Maybe some of you know it, because it's from the Center of Urban Pedagogy, which is a group of designers that works together with lawyers and people who know about regulations and how to interpret them. And they have a series of publications. And this project, The Vendor Power, is from 2009. And they designed it because in New York, there is a massive problem of immigration, and mostly a big amount of immigrants are from Mexico and Central America, so they don't speak English, so they don't know their rights in the city. So they designed the Vendor Power because one of the main activities these people do is to become vendor powers, because street vendors, because they don't have the legal right to work in a company, they are illegal immigrants, so the way to economically survive is to become street vendors. But you can see the scenes when police is coming closer and these people just pack up their things and start running because they don't know their rights. So what the Center for Urban Pedagogy did was to prepare a manual when they explain in a very IKEA style all the regulations in different neighborhoods in New York, so the people know if they have the right to use a part of the street or not, or in which streets is easier, because for example, if you are in the Fifth Avenue, it's completely forbidden because the companies and like Zara or Massimo Dutti or whatever pay a lot to have the sidewalk free so people can see the window shops. But there are other neighborhoods that not. You are allowed to use the sidewalks and the public space. So in this manual, they share all this information in an easy way, so it doesn't matter if you don't speak English very clear, but you understand. And you have also a tool. If a police come and say, you have to move it from here, you can say no. I have legal right because in this part of the constitution or whatever, it says that I can use the public space. So I think it's very important because when we talk about the public space, we also talk about education. Because to transform these pop-up architecture examples or whatever to something more stable in time, we need to be educated in the regulations of our cities. So I think it's a very good example, and it's very linked to this project, the Silent University. This is a pedagogical project that has been born in 2012, and they give education to people who is asylum seeker in different countries. The problem is related with the previous project, because when you are an asylum seeker, you don't know the language, or you don't know your rights, so you become afraid of being in public space. Usually we can see, or I don't know how it's here, but for example in Barcelona, if you go to a public space during certain time of the day, you see only local people. And after it's getting darker, immigrants start coming out, and the children start playing, but in the dark, because they are afraid of showing themselves during the day. So if you can share with these people that they have rights to use the city becomes richer, because if we avoid segregation, what you have is richness in the cultural and social development of any city. So they do these kind of activities with round tables, presentations, in places like this, for example, but also they do the activities outside in the public space to show the people that they can be there. Because it's not the same to have them in a closed space and tell them, okay, now you can go out because you have the right, than to enhance them and be with them there and showing them that they have the right to use these spaces for different kind of purposes, as a lecture or just playing or whatever. And to do that, they publish also every year a manual with articles and legal issues about these kind of conflicts in the city and how you can react to them. But how can we go from the pedagogical inputs to something more more architectural, let's say, using the public space with infrastructure or whatever? This is a very good example that it's like an evolution of the previous one, because it has also the aim to be like pedagogical, to show you some problems, but they are actively using the public space. It's called the Conflict Kitchen, and it was born in US because you know that United States is a big hegemonic country, let's say. They have a conflict with different countries because these countries doesn't act as they want. And usually all the information that the citizens in the United States have comes only from mass media, and they don't have the real information, because mostly all of mass media, not all, of course, they are independent publications or shows in TV, but the most popular are always manipulated by the governments, and they follow certain ideologies. So what these people do is to set up their stores, and on each store, of a food store, they do, like a small restaurant, they talk about a particular country, let's say Cuba, for example. We all know the relationship between United States and Cuba, how it is, but also with Venezuela or Iraq. And they do all the communication through the food, because in each restaurant, they only sell food of that country. So while the people have the motivation of being tasting new flavors, and also food has always been linked with the social issues of every culture. So through the food, you can start trying to understand what is happening in these cities. You can see this was the previous one was Venezuela. This is from Cuba. But also they use these pedagogical tools that we were talking before, and they share information about the conflict. So people is not only eating or just like a divertimento, they can really learn what is happening there. And I think we met the first day we were here, we met this guy from America that he didn't even know where Stockholm was, for example. It was, so I think this, for this kind of people who only have one source of information, very linear, to have all these other sources to learn more about these other countries, this situation, how long in time these conflicts have been taking time. I think it's a very nice project. And also, it has the one thing that I think is very important, because I was also, since 2011, when I was researching all these a do-it-yourself project that emerged after the crisis, that one of the biggest problems of these projects is economy. Because, okay, you can join a group of friends, set up whatever you want, but you are investing your own resources, your time, and nobody pays you for that, only maybe if you have a funding for an art foundation. But this project is a good example, because by selling the food, they get revenues to pay from the local. They have rented for the material they have produced. So it's also economically sustainable. And I think this is very important if we are talking about a long-term project that can be more economically sustainable and more stable. We have in Barcelona one that it's also in public space. and it's a bigger scale than the previous one, and it's about a public space that was closed because this space was supposed, it's owned by the municipality, and was supposed to be for educational issues. The municipality wanted to build there a school and an institute, but then the crisis arrived and the municipality get bankrupted almost, and they simply kept the space empty but closed. So after the first years, people was complaining because people has children, they need a school there or where to take it, and start realizing that there was a space there. And maybe if the municipality doesn't have the money to do something, it's enough if they open the space because people can use it. So if you don't have money, at least let me use the space because I'm paying my taxes and the space in the city is mine at the end. So they start doing these small meetings. You can see the group is super reduced, but there are artists, architects, and people, local people. And the meetings every 15 days started growing. The project started in 2012, and the meetings were bigger and bigger. And this was a very important moment because they start doing activities in the space to catch up the attention of media also. So they joined this project by GR that he has been developing in several cities, picturing the people. But also they have really engaged the neighborhoods. All people here is from the neighborhood, and they were cooking paellas and to share and give a space for the people to talk and to really express the needs they have for the neighborhood. And there was a group of activists that built this artifact, this device. And I was telling that it was a very important moment for the project, because when people climb that space and look to the other side of the fence, they realize the size and the potential of the space. And until that moment, all the neighborhoods joined forces in a stronger way until they forced the local government to open it. And now the space is open in the time frame of 2 years, and they have started building this dome to have some activities. This is the opening day. So you can see that it was slower than any pop-up or do-it-yourself project, but at the end the result is it's also more stable. It gives a stability to the neighborhood, because even if it's not at a school, almost all the activities they do there has relationship with education, and they do workshops, people come and they have a urban garden in this side. So somehow they are creating the need in the neighborhood to keep asking for their rights, and when money arrives, they already has in their mentality that the purpose of this space is going to be for education, they will help to take care of it. So I think it's a very good example to trying to think in a long-term condition about these kind of initiatives. And the other one, and this is the last one, it's also a big scale project, it's even larger than the previous, and it's in Guatemala. So I select this one because I wanted to show that this kind of situation we are living, and we have been talking a lot about Europe, but this is worldwide. The way that the government manipulate the space, the city, and the need for the people to react and to take back the right to the city, it's something that it's extended in almost every city in the world. So we can, by comparing different kind of projects, also we can learn a lot what we can use in our city or what not, because it responds to a specific context. So okay, I don't do this part of the process, but maybe I can learn from this. And this is a project about, it's called Post-Conflicto Laboratory, because in Guatemala there was an armed conflict in the 80s, 70s and 80s. And a genocide of the people from the small villages. So they are working with the notion of post-conflict city. No, how the people that has suffered this abuse doesn't have the
doesn't feel that they can coexist with the people who was the abuser in their mind, because population is one part and politicians and military are other. But it has created a fragmentation and segregation in the city. So this group of architects started researching in the roots of the conflict and how the conflict has driven to people to join groups like the guerrillas or the, in Chiapas, in Mexico, the Zapatistas, because Chiapas is very close to Guatemala, so they have the same cultural roots. And start researching from the first level of information to understand the mentality of these people and to try to design something for them. So after all the research project, they started doing workshops with people of these small villages and communities to research of their needs and how they imagine their cities or their housing projects. And they now are developing a project in two parts because the most important problem they found was the segregation, as I told you before, between these two groups, the medium higher class people and the lower class people. So they analyze in the process that the basic cell of social relationship is housing, because it's where you relate with your family, but in your family you have children that go to school and relate to others. Your parents go to work and relate to others. So at home is where you can have conversations about other people, how they think, and how to integrate with them. So they decide to do the project in these two sites together, but not from the scratch, mixing up the people, because it can be also too strong and people will reject it. So to make the two projects at the same time in the same place but different projects, and doing the public space available for everybody, trying to research if this segregation can be avoided. And this is part of the design they have. The quality of the housing is the same. They are not dismissing anything, but you just don't want to be so strong to try to make everybody, people who is in conflict with the other, for the first moment. But from the research they have been done, they think that it's possible to make a change in long term. I'm not sure if it will succeed, but I found the research super interesting because it's a very strong basis with personal interviews, workshops, etc. So they also have understand that maybe this hatred or reaction that is between one class or one group and the other, it's almost all the time created by the government, because it's a tool for manipulation at the same time. If you don't mix up with other people, they can manipulate you and they can manipulate the other group, because segregation is like that. So I'm very curious about to see the evolution of this project and if they can succeed or at least make small cells of this project. And this drives me to question or to reflect on this quote by David Harvey, because it's very related with all of these projects. If we want to have a better city, I think we need first to question which kind of person we want to be. Because if you don't change from the inside or your mind or the way you will use these tools that we were talking about before, your project will not be good for the city, because they will become very superficial. We need to go to the roots of the problems, try to understand them, and then the solutions perhaps can be good for our cities. So I like to think that this kind of projects will be the new bird droppings that can make a richer place where we live. So thank you very much.
Well, I don't have any answers either.
It's difficult to have answers.
I'm very grateful for these examples, because I think it's one thing that we are very aware of, that all the kind of alternative strategies that are engaged in public spheres are immediately copied and used by commercial forces, mm-hmm. and that is, so I think this is a very depressing sign of trying to find new ways, because they're going, the path is not proven, it's open, and then Red Bull will make use of it or something. So then I find that these examples are more sustainable than many other things that I've been seeing. So, but still, one asks, these are projects that are in areas of I wouldn't say perhaps always conflict, but there's a severe problem with illegal immigrants or so on. Could you see how this could be used also in a more like non-conflict area?
Mm-hmm.
Or is the conflict the kind of is there needs there to be something that needs to be sown in that very obvious way? Can one kind of think about this kind of strategies in a suburb, perhaps in Sweden or so?
Yes, I know
where they of course are also illegal immigrants, but I mean, you see what I mean?
Yes, maybe. We can talk about conflict not in so depressing sense and asylum seeker or whatever, but for example, with the project you show, there was a certain kind of conflict when they opened this neighborhood and the media told something and the people. So I think that this is inherent in our history in every country. And because, of course, politicians and urban planners that work with politicians, I'm not saying every urban planner, but they respond to certain ideas and also the power of capital, because when you are designing a city, this city needs to be sustainable and there need to be jobs and stores and whatever. But sometimes the only fact that they don't research is the needs of the people, the real needs. So maybe that's where the conflict comes, and it should not be always so drastic as immigrant, etc. But there is always a need for you in your city that you need to ask for the government. And of course, there are different kind of governments too. But the general we are witnessing right now, the general state of politics in the world, they are not responding to that need. So I think that's why maybe there's no need for conflict, but that's why in this moment it's so important that the conflict can have a canal to materialize or to... I'm not sure, but I think that it's like a... It's natural, it's human, so it's...
I have a question for you about the scale of these projects as well. And to pick up on what you were saying, I mean, John Stuart Mill said years after he wrote On Liberty, someone asked him if he still subscribed to utilitarianism, and he said, even if you could give people what makes them happy, they only know what makes them unhappy. And in a way, this kind of question of conflict seems to be that, and we know this from democratic manifestations and protests and so on, that people only polarize around what they don't want rather than what they want. So I wonder if that's not part of how people begin the process of self-organization. But the other question is that, we have effectively, I think we're living in a period of, in many cases, the failure of the nation state. And its increasing obsolescence as a geopolitical territory. And so my question is, it's okay maybe at the scale of, let's say, one local school, but even then, we can't manage to completely run our own school. I mean, you look at the way that in May 68, factories were commandeered. Mm-hmm. And there is no kind of communist revolution as far as these occupation of these locations goes. Now, how would we run a police service or all the tools that we would normally associate with the welfare state, a healthcare service and things like this, in an autonomous way? I mean, this kind of, I'm very interested in the moment at which we can begin to make the jump between the scale of a local school, the scale of a small suburb or of a small development, like post-conflict laboratory, and then how we make that jump beyond that, and whether or not you think this is a model that can be scaled up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, by the way, yes, I agree with you. It's very difficult because there are certain topics that even if I love and I believe in self-organization for certain conditions, I guess, but education, health, I think they need another kind of interventions. And I selected these two projects because they, both of them are in collaboration with the government. The Barcelona one couldn't have happened if after joining forces with the people and have a formal proposal, they haven't visited the municipality and they have a, how do you say that, committed to use the space under certain regulations on the condition that the municipality, when they start raising more taxes and the situation gets more stable, will act to give the school. And also post-conflicto laboratory, if, well, especially you, I think you know Roberto,
yes.
No? They are working together with the municipality of Guatemala to give a space in the city, in the most proper place maybe to start this development and mix up these families. So I think this is part of the richness of this project that, well, as I told before, I don't know if they will be successful, but they are not rejecting us in the manifestations or our revolutions that the government is the bad and I'm the good. No, they know the opponent and they are working with them to try to find a solution. And I think this is what makes these projects interesting. And I'm just following them to see how they evolve. But yes, it's because of that, because I agree with you. So only working together, because you cannot hide and make like the government doesn't exist or capitalism doesn't exist. No, it's there. So it's better if you know, and then you know how to use it in your project. So.
Opportunism, if we have this discussion and we finally hope to find out about the subversive opportunism. But I don't want to get in the political discussion because, if I understand this correctly from your presentation, the root of all the problems is capitalism, yes?
More or less, yeah.
Not in this country, probably, which is through communism, you can propagate communism or anarchist ideas, but in this project, I saw actually very strong polarization. You find the enemy, as in the 68 in the Europe, yeah? You look for the enemy, which is government always must manipulate, you must find the enemy which manipulates. But what happens when money arrives? And what happens then? What is the consequence of all these projects? Where is the opportunism happening?
Yes, I think it's a very interesting question because, yes, by the way, one point is that about polarization is not that strong because maybe in the presentation it wasn't clear, but it's what I told to Jack, that they are working together with government. So, yes, maybe the enemy, the concept of enemy is there, but they try to not to polarize that, just to bring them into the project as partners. So this is when opportunism emerged because usually money works in direct relationship with the governments. Because governments allow you to, I don't know, to set up certain kind of markets or stores in a maybe in a street that wasn't for commercial use before. The government is the one to approve. So if they bring the government into the conversation, they are also a direct relationship with the market and what can happen when the money arrives, because they will know if all the project is being working together between government and a group of local people, both of them are working together in the next steps of the project. So if money arrives and is part of the next step, they can work together to see how to use that that market or that...
But have the position that money arrives because of manipulation or to buy them, because you had the position, in instant position, initial position, that it will be wrong, they will buy us. by our free ideas or something like that.
Well, this is happening everywhere in the world. It's a fact. It's a fact. Yeah.
Not necessarily something that wants to manipulate something.
Yeah, I think the market. This is my personal position, of course. The market always tries to manipulate because they only work for their growth, the market, I'm saying. So I that's why I find interesting to have this side-by-side cooperation with the governments to see how the market can be one actor more in the same scale as the local people, as the government, and the market, and not the one who will... try to colonize you. But in my humble opinion, this is happening everywhere. I'm not from Spain. I was born in El Salvador and have lived in Spain, in Europe, and been traveling, and you see certain... maybe the cultural context is different, the social context, the history, but then the common layer between all countries, it's all the unique common link is how the market develops in every country. I can be wrong, of course, this is my personal opinion.
But I'm thinking about this term of subversive opportunism. I think it comes to me now that when we talk in the seminar here that it is certain kind of practices that take place in the public space.
Mm-hmm.
It is different between the term of activist and the term of dissident.
Mm-hmm.
I think dissident relates more with those who are inside of a certain system, which is perhaps even hidden from public.
Yeah.
In a way that basically the kind of realization that the goal of a system is some kind of a failure. This morning I was kind of coming back to core of what is dissident. So the nuclear scientist Sakharov, who got the Nobel Peace Prize in 1975. So he was a prominent nuclear scientist. He operated within kind of high kind of, levels of power. And then he realizes the same as Edward Snowden, for example, or Julian Assange, in a way that the system kind of operates in a false direction, and only he has the knowledge to explain to the public what is happening. And interesting thing happens with that USSR signs the Helsinki Accords, of principles, and installs the principle of human rights, and there suddenly all these figures, which are inside of the system, they find the point where they can speak out.
Mm-hmm.
So there. Weight of them makes possible to create this space of exchange of ideas, exchange of facts.
Mm-hmm.
The Helsinki group, which still operates in Russia,
is
based on that, on making things public,
mm-hmm.
Making hidden stories visible. That's kind of really relates to Soviet times, but in a way we find this kind of a figure of dissident which sees the system somehow from its own kind of engagement or obsessive engagement or its expert knowledge, you know, somehow the transition from this hidden realm into public.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think that kind of difference is. Between the activist and dissident, in a way, kind of maybe can also kind of have that as a point where we can clearly define the that is not so clear.
No. Yeah.
That's where we can start be in public space. Mm-hmm. And we can discuss who's right or wrong.
Yeah. I very much agree with you. I think that maybe one of the differences that usually the dissident that you are mentioned works alone.
Yeah.
And this kind of activist that can be another kind of dissident as well works in groups, collectively. And maybe this because how many Julian Assange or Edward Snowden we have, or at least that famous. So maybe one of the doors that has been opened also by them themselves is that with this information, people feel that they have something to fight and they get collectively acting. So maybe it's a thing that enrich one from the other, no? Because they make this information public for some reason. And people take this information and try to understand what is happening and to react to that. So maybe, or perhaps it's interesting not to think in these two layers separately, but how one depends on the other, or how can one can learn or use the information that the other gives to them. But because, for example, Julian Assange, okay, he's the visible face, but the group behind WikiLeaks, it's very wide. So how can the two parts are important and necessary for another kind of projects or situations to happen? I don't know.
Julian Assange is not the kind of dissident, but he is the creator of the space where the revelation could take place. And it's the in-between figure.
Yeah.
Who finances
him?
Yeah, exactly. So who finances him?
In incidents, we talk about the conscious and the consciousness and the risk involved. And in activism, for example, those people who established a project for those street vendors, they wouldn't be ever go to court and sent to somewhere or deported because they started this action. That's activism for rights, for many things. And the dissidents, the direct risk is involved in losing your profession, your reputation, your money, or even your life. So that's how we explain this, this difference.
Yeah.
And in activism, of course, in countries which are not democratic, it's also risk is much more involved than in the States or in Paris, where you establish the public spaces to integrate immigrants or somewhere else. So it's activism also has this difference in different countries.